Up next, investigative reporter Cheryl Jones joins us. She's got an incredible story about time and how it works in our universe. Looking forward to that, so we'll get into that. And then in our last hour, we'll take almost like open line calls with Cheryl. Just make your calls about what her topic was tonight or other ones that she's done and jump on board with conversations with Cheryl in our last hour. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our special guest, of course, who appears with us monthly, investigative reporter Cheryl Jones. She's been a news anchor and meteorologist at networks of CNN, the Weather Channel, and here she is. Cheryl, it's you talking about time tonight. It's amazing we're going into March in just a few days.
Yes, we are. Boy, is time flying. Are we having fun yet?
Yeah, well, you know, COVID aside, not bad, not bad. How about you? How are you coping with that?
Doing fine, all things considered. Just anxious to get through and to get back to normal.
Well, that's great. Well, now tell us a little bit about what you've got going on tonight.
George, it's all about time tonight and what people do when they see glimpses of their own lives into the future. And tonight I interview science fiction author, writer, and teacher Dennis Caracciolo about his new novel, Doorway to Time. And that's the result of his lifelong curiosity about the elusive essence of time and how time works in our whole universe. It turns out each character in his book finds a bizarre book of time by surprise, and when that book is opened up, it shows a shocking, life-changing event with a glimpse into the future that will change their lives forever. But they each have to decide what to do about what they foresee. Dennis tells me now that some unusual events in his own early life led him down this science fiction pathway to this very novel. Most fascinating, I found, is that a famous president is the common thread connecting characters and events in this future time thriller, with parts of real nonfiction events, some chilling, blended into the science fiction throughout the compelling stories. Listen now to our conversation.
Hello, Dennis. Welcome to Coast.
Well, thank you very much, Cheryl, for having me.
We're so happy to have you here with us tonight, and it's your first time here on Coast.
That's right.
Tell us a little about your work with science fiction. How did you get started?
Well, for me, science fiction began very, very early. It was science fiction film, never any writing, of course, as a kid. Saw everything there was, you know. I think a turning point for me was seeing the original War of the Worlds. That had a great effect on me. And then all of the good, the bad, and the ugly of science fiction that came down through the years and so forth. And then The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. That had an effect. And it just hooked me as a genre. And I won't say that's all I've ever written, but certainly it took off much later, really after college. I'd written a lot of other, mystery, social novels and so forth. But then fast forwarding up to about 10, 12 years ago, I started Doorway to Time, my book for which I'm here now, penetrating deeply into the science of time.
You might have been a little obsessed with science fiction as a kid. You built rockets, a time machine. Tell us about that.
Well, time machine's a little silly, but yeah, I was always in the backyard building rocket. My father built a great shack in the backyard, and that served as a rocket ship, and it had a trap door, this and that and the other. I still did a lot of other things as well, but during this entire time, kept seeing a lot of science fiction, a lot of scary science fiction, and then Twilight Zone hit. When Twilight Zone hit for me, Rod Serling's great epic, I stayed home on Friday nights. I didn't want to miss it. And there were some episodes. One of my favorite writers, Richard Matheson, who wrote probably his best on Twilight Zone, was And When the Sky Was Opened. That was one of the scariest things I think I ever saw. It scared me. I didn't sleep for a week, but then I wanted more. And it kept multiplying and just seeing everything there was. And anything with time, monsters, you know, went by the wayside. You realize as you get older, there are no monsters. But that time element, that stayed with me.
In your book, Doorway to Time, you have 11 most interesting and very different characters. Each could have been a separate episode of Twilight Zone, couldn't they?
I think so. And I do want to emphasize one thing, and that is this is not really a collection of short stories. Doorway to Time, yes, 11 characters, separate periods, eras. But in the end, it is all brought together, explained, and I consider it to be a complete novel.
Dennis, of all the aspects of science fiction that you could write about, how did you zero in on and develop the idea of Doorway to Time?
It's one of those things that just struck me about 12 years ago or so. I had an experience, believe it or not, in the seventh grade. That's the seventh grade that is still has ramifications even now. I was destined for a private high school, not the local public high school. And yet I kept going over there all the time on Saturdays, you know, looking at windows and who could have graduated here, what football stars sat there and so forth. And still wanted to go to that private school, took the test, got in. But after 1 year there, I left and did end up in that public school. Now, I know what the psychologist is going to say. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't think so, because what led to those 3 years I spent in that school really has paid endless rewards for me in friendships, associations, and so forth. And I'm even now in great touch with alumni. I helped as much as I could establish that school's Sports Hall of Fame and so forth. I went even back to that school to coach some football. And that school became a focal point in my life that I've never forgotten and, you know, is very treasured by me. Now, this is captured in the second portion of Doorway to Time in the portion titled A Glimpse of Time. And I frankly admit that that character in that portion is me. And he meets with a psychiatrist, a very unusual psychiatrist, who he tells the same story too. And the psychiatrist says this: is it possible that you somehow remembered forward? Remembered forward. And I wonder if time is on a loop, and there are physicists who believe it, is it possible to think ahead to what may come? I'm just offering that as a possibility.
You reference President John F. Kennedy most profoundly and almost every portion of Doorway in one way or another. Why?
It is my opinion that the assassination of President Kennedy marked a turning point, not just in world history, American history, together, because everything changed after that assassination, November 22nd, 1963. And music changed, language changed, education changed, even the Catholic Church dropped Latin, adopted English, turned the altar around and faced the people. Everything changed. And in the first portion of Doorway to Time, which also has that same title, a man finds the Book of Time, which is what this whole novel is about, predicting the assassination the next day. Well, at first he says, this is insane, ridiculous. Who would write such a grim thing? But it's not just a generalized prediction. It points out the doctors who will be operating on Kennedy, describes the Dealey Plaza, describes the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital later that night. So he finally, he's sort of convinced, could this be true? Then the book vanishes from his midst. But he had taken notes, and he starts calling Parkland Hospital, and he finds out that the very doctors described in this portion did indeed exist at Parkland Hospital. Then he calls the Texas School Book Depository and finds out there is a Lee Harvey Oswald who works on the sixth floor. And it's that moment, a bone-chilling moment for him. He says, this book is accurately predicting what is going to happen to the president tomorrow. And that is when he gets on a plane and he heads for Dallas. I won't say the rest. I'll let the readers, I don't want to give it away, let the readers enjoy and hopefully learn from what he learned.
So you blend a lot of nonfiction into your fiction in Doorway to Time.
Well, it's a personal tie-in as well. I've researched that investigation, many have, and it taught me a lot through the years. I've connected with people like Cyril Wecht, forensic pathologist in Pittsburgh, who was the pathologist who went into the National Archives and discovered John F. Kennedy's brain was missing from the National Archives. I've talked to David Lifton, who wrote what I think is the finest, most compelling book in the entire Kennedy assassination pantheon, which is Best Evidence. I'll say this, if you can read that book and come back and say that there's nothing wrong with that assassination, I will come over and eat that book. I mean, it's compelling. It proves that there's something very, very wrong. And of course, this stayed in my mind. So when I wrote Doorway to Time, I wanted the first story to center around actually the assassination, when the main character goes back to Dallas and what he finds and what he learned.
So it provides more or less of a grounding in terms of a time frame around everything for the characters in your book.
That's right. In the succeeding portions, character finds the book that tells of 911. He realizes his nephew is working in one of the Twin Towers. In another portion, this is Bay Area connected. I live in the Bay Area. The Loma Prieta earthquake, which he realizes his wife is going to drive over. There was a collapse of a freeway. It was called the Cypress Freeway. Collapsed in the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989. That was a 7.1 earthquake. And so he tries to do what he can to prevent it. Now, the question becomes, can you prevent history? I don't believe you can, even if you were somehow to go back in time. But that isn't the point. The point is the effect all of this has on the character's life and what they learn.
What do you want people to take away from reading Doorway to Time?
Well, it's like any literature. What the main character learns is what we learn. The greatest lesson I ever learned about writing at San Francisco State University was that whether you're writing a short story, a play, or a novel, you've got three acts. And I had a wonderful professor. He called it the problem, the passion, and the perception. And that third part, the perception, what that main character learns is what we in turn learn. And there's got to be a perception, or else why read it? You know, Hamlet dies. Macbeth dies in the end. Othello dies in the end. But before they die, they learn what they needed to learn. And in turn, we learn it. I think that's the basis of all literature. And that would be very rewarding for me. And then when they read that final 10th portion of Doorway to Time, to really reflect on it, and think about some things they never quite thought about that way.
And character is very strong throughout Doorway to Time.
That's a big one. Science fiction has always had the rap that its focus is technology. And that's true, pretty much true. Character, if there is any, comes way down the line second. To me, character is the essence of all literature, whether it's Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Sophocles and Oedipus Rex, you name it. Without character, I think the literature is not quite, does not hold up as well. But science fiction has gotten away with that because it's been about machines and cloning and colonization and the DNA molecule and on and on. To me, literature without character is poor, and I tried as best I could to include character in my writing. It's very important. And I think, I hope that the readers will agree when they read these 10 portions.
Well, I'm looking forward to his second half, Cheryl. He sounds exciting.
He is. And by the way, he sold rides to his friends on that time machine that he built as a child in his backyard. So he had a little bit of an entrepreneurial business sense to him, even growing up. But he puts a different twist in this sci-fi novel. As he said, it's highly autobiographical, with a blend of real events and science fiction. So there's a final purpose to each character in the Book of Time when confronted face to face with what to do about that glimpse into the future. What would any of us do if we found a book that precisely predicted an event with lots of details that you could verify, as with this character in the book, in the story about JFK with such a plan that turned out to be real as time went on. Now, the character who found that book of time predicting the assassination, by the way, was an Iowa farmer.
Interesting. Now, there is a book about 9/11 before there was a 9/11.
Yes, and when we get to the second segment, we'll be talking about some of these books that have the most eerie predictions of things that in some ways did come true. So that'll be a part of the upcoming segment.
And, of course, in our last hour, conversations with Cheryl, open line type calls, so just jump on board. Have you been following the story of the pilot who saw the UFO over New Mexico?
Yes, with the cylinder-shaped,
yep,
missile-like object that was reported by the pilot. In the beginning, there was some question as to whether or not that actual transmission was from the flight crew itself, but the last reports that I saw, and also I believe Kevin Randall mentioned this as well, was that that it was from the flight crew. So it is very interesting, but we always have to remember that we're getting more reports of all of these things now because of the openness of the media as a result of the 2017 New York Times article that verified that the Pentagon was seriously interested. So as these things continue to develop, I think we're finding that there's more and more verification of a serious interest on the part of the government.
Well, in the old days, too, Cheryl, they would be very, very hush-hush about this, and they're not anymore.
They're not, however. I do have some friends who are pilots, and I do get a little bit of a different story on exactly what the reality is in terms of the freedom to report these kinds of things without any concern about
repercussions.
Right, exactly. So in this case, it seemed to be so blatantly obvious that it wasn't that easy to just brush away.
What would our old friend Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut, say about all this stuff right now?
Oh, I think about him from time to time. What a wonderful, wonderful person. I was so honored and lucky to be a friend of his as well after initially meeting him at the X conferences. And I know sometimes we sat at the same table, if you'll recall, with Edgar Mitchell. And I was blessed to be able to visit in his home along with some other people and have some sessions with him. And I think he would be very pleased. And he might raise an eyebrow with some of the methods of the reporting, mm-hmm. The fact that the reports sometimes come across as it's a first-time event. These are not the first times that we've seen or had reports of even the cylinder-shaped objects. So, you know, those of us like yourself, obviously, who have been around a little bit longer before the stories became okay to report in mainstream news, remember so many reports of the past that have come forth from pilots and others over the decades. So it's good that mainstream news is taking notice, but it's not something that's just happening. We have digital media now and all other kinds of ways. Things are far more open, so I think it's just a progression of the times.
We're going to come back in just a moment with part two of Cheryl's interview, Doorway to Time and Strange Fiction, just ahead on Coast to Coast AM, so just get ready. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Cheryl Jones, who's continuing her story of time with an incredible novel, of course, Doorway to Time and Strange Fiction. I like this Dennis guy, don't you?
Yes, he's very, very interesting to talk to, and as he mentioned in the last report, he's done extensive research on the JFK assassination, and it's just so compelling when you start reading through the book. I haven't had a chance to read all of it because it's quite thick, but I've read through quite a bit of it, and it's just compelling how he has blended and connected the common thread of JFK throughout all of the chapters and connected with all of the characters involved.
He seems to be pretty psychic, is he?
Well, he says he's not. And we do talk about the difference in psychic and what it is that creates the situation where some sci-fi books and writings actually end up more or less predicting, at least partially, some events that do come true. So that's a part of this next segment coming up.
All right. Pick up segment two. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. We'll continue talking about the entire mystique of time, the essence of time. And as I mentioned earlier, that's something that has really fascinated Dennis from his early childhood. It's all about the bizarre concept in this book of the Book of Time that reveals glimpses into the future. And it makes you think, what would we do if we were confronted with a shocking prediction in our own lives? So we dig deeper into the high strangeness of some of the sci-fi writings of the past that tell of future events that actually come bone-chillingly close to things that really happened. Dennis shares with us his perspective on sci-fi writings that seem to partially foretell aspects of future events decades before they happen, with eerie detail, much of which has come true. There's Eyes of Darkness by Dean Koontz in 1981, with a coronavirus described from the Wuhan lab in China, and Ingersoll Lockwood's classic Baron Trump adventure stories telling of the rise of a 21st century U.S. president, written in 1890. Some mysteries help explain things, Dennis contends, but some things remain mysterious. Listen now to our conversation.
Dennis, do you believe every living person could potentially have their own book of time? And if people could really see it, how do you think most people would react, or how would lives be affected if they knew something so significant in their future was going to happen?
I don't believe people have their own book of time with pages and descriptions of what's going to happen. But I do believe there's intuition. I think some people follow it, some people don't. We're getting into heavy psychology here, but I don't think that it's physical. I think that it's probably intuitive. You know, many science fiction writers have traveled down that path, whether it's psychic prediction, you know, Jules Verne predicting submarines in 1860, 1870. Some critics have referred to this as speculative anticipation. But nevertheless, they wrote of things that would later come to be. How they got that is anyone's guess. There are so many writers that cross that line. If you knew what was in front of you, what would you do? That's a hard question to answer. I think some people see what's in front of them and they avoid it. But that's my opinion.
And you bring up an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about. Could science fiction possibly plant a seed of thought that could give someone with bad intentions an idea that they might go back to and develop later on and act upon that at some future moment of opportunity? There are several situations where a book seems to predict future events, and one of those is Eyes of Darkness by Dean Koontz, written in 1981. The eerie detail in that book about a pandemic and a virus, with so much of that turning out to be true because we're living it now. There are others of note. Travels and Adventures of Little Baron Trump and the Rise of a 21st Century President, and also A Capital Attack. And that was written in 1890. There's The Simpsons. Many of their episodes frequently predicted things that surprisingly came true. And as you mentioned, The War of the Worlds and The Time Machine, as well as 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then there's Jurassic Park. How can all these writers hit the nail on the head with so many future situations?
It's a good question. You mentioned Dean Koontz. That was, what, 81? Not only did he predict the virus coming from China, he even said it would be coming from Wuhan, China. That's quite a remarkable prediction. But there have been many. Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, the classic book written on eugenics. Now, that hasn't happened yet, and I hope it doesn't, but it does bring up the question of cloning. Look at Jurassic Park. All those dinosaurs had been cloned.
There are some people who believe that we have clones or even hybrids among us already. And as you say, if you see it developing, then somewhere someone is already on that track.
Yes.
Could it be that this is already being done, that we already have clones among us or hybrids among us, so to speak?
I can't say. I really don't know. It's a tough one for me to call. I cannot disprove it. I guess that's my answer.
As this technology develops, as it obviously will with time, will we be facing a bigger crisis with ethics as we go along?
Well, your question makes me think of Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. And in that story, they take a guy with a 70 IQ and they perform surgery on him and turn him into a genius. And then it begins to decline. And he eventually does go back to that 70 IQ person. The question is, should science do whatever it's capable of doing? If science can flex its muscles and clone Brave New World and do produce nothing but Einsteins, do we want that kind of world?
How could you stop this technology from getting into the hands of people who do have ill intentions?
Well, that's a good one. You're probably going to have some type of government intervention is probably the only way. I'm not sure. It has not happened. I know we've cloned some mammals, animals. I can't say if it's gone beyond that. Some say it has. Some may have gone wrong and it resulted in the, the death of whatever they were testing.
Dennis, where do you think all of these glimpses of future time are coming from? Could these messages be from another dimension or a place beyond time? What do you think is happening?
The final portion of my book, titled Beyond Space and Time, deals with that whole issue about 110, 115 years from now, when a researcher has at his disposal a master computer, the likes of which we cannot even now dream. And he has determined the reason this book has appeared to all of these people. If I answer that, then I give everything away, and I don't want to do that.
Dennis, if you were to look back over your whole career in science fiction and writing, what specific science fiction writers or novels influenced you the most?
Oh, my favorite question. Well, you have to have a tip of the cap to Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. Okay, it starts really with them. I would say my most favorite writers, Arthur C. Clarke, no surprise there. I think Isaac Asimov wrote the greatest science fiction in history in the Foundation trilogy. 15,000 years in the future when the galaxy is colonized. My personal favorite is Richard Matheson. Matheson wrote Somewhere in Time. He also wrote many, many episodes for The Twilight Zone. And he wrote The Incredible Shrinking Man, many others. It's that otherworldly sense of the weird that I like the best. And that was Matheson. I love Matheson. And of course, Rod Serling. How could we leave him out? I think there was something like 220 few episodes of The Twilight Zone. He wrote 190. I mean, that's mind-boggling. He's been a major influence on me.
Dennis, given the fact that there were so many predictions that came through from many of the sci-fi writers and books and movies, do you think they possibly could have been psychic?
I don't think they were psychic. I think they had a great imagination. They saw trends, the ones that I'm talking now about, those that predicted things that happened. If I could name one book, not a science fiction, and I'll never forget this. This was Megatrends by John Nesbitt, 1980. Now, he was more in the social realm, predicting the explosion of networking, working at home. He said there would be five states that would be really bellwether states. And if I can recall correctly, California, state of Washington, Texas, Colorado, Florida, that would determine, the trends of the future. But what amazed me was he said that what led him to his understanding of what he thought would come was by reading every single small town newspaper he could get his hands on in the country, because there you have the most grassroots belief of the, quote, common person, close quote, And from that, he said he was able to predict what he thought would come. And it's an amazing book, Megatrends, John Naisbitt.
So if not psychic, then certainly very smart and quite genius.
Yes, I think so. We go back to the great H.G. Wells, predicted in 1895 the next war would be fought in the air, World War I, predicted atomic power, predicted war tanks. On the island of Dr. Moreau, mutations and cloning and so forth. And he wrote on general history as well. You know, the great quote from H.G. Wells was, civilization is a race between education and catastrophe. Wells was not positive about the future, especially when it came to what he thought atomic power would come and destroy us all. But I don't think, again, it's anything to do with psychic. It's genius intuition. Best way I can describe it.
On the subject of time, which sure gets a lot of attention, a lot of credit and blame too, depending on the situation, with a lot of common phrases like lost time or time flies, it's almost like there's an invisible hand of time upon us. Dennis, are we overly obsessed with time?
I personally do not believe that people think enough about it, not that they should. Most people just carry on with their lives. I think most people probably don't think about it much at all other than look at a clock. I do not believe that time is really the clock. You know, I think of the major differences between Isaac Newton, who believed there was space and time, and Einstein in special relativity told us that there's a space-time continuum. Newton believed time flowed equably. Einstein said it does not. So people don't really want to go into that, don't care that much about it. They may enjoy an occasional science fiction story. Einstein's time dilation effect, the faster you go, the more time tends to slow down. And many a science fiction writer has played around with that one. But no, I don't think most people think that deeply about it, no.
After a lifetime of work in science fiction and researching time, Dennis, at this point, what aspect remains most perplexing to you now?
Well, the facet of it, I think, is exactly what I tried to understand the last 7-10 years in writing Doorway to Time, and that was Einstein's space-time continuum. I didn't get that. I kept reading and reading over and over. Finally, I think it hit me what he was talking about, and that fascinates me. And the time dilation effect, time slowing down, the faster one goes. And we're talking about major speeds. We're not talking about airplanes here. That interests me. And the mystery of it interests me. And as I say in my title, could there be a doorway to time?
Where can people find out more about your fascinating book?
They can go to lulu.com. And either type in the novel title, Doorway to Time, or go to the bookshop. It's there. I also recommend go to the Facebook page, Doorway to Time. You'll see my musings there and so forth. And I think the fastest, best way, again, is to go to Lulu, lulu.com, and type in the title.
It's such a magical universe. Dennis, I hate to say this, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for your fascinating conversation. It's been a joy talking with you tonight about Doorway to Time.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, for having me. I really appreciate it.
And George, it's also fascinating, very thought-provoking. Even though it's science fiction, I've read some but not all, it's so hard to put down because what it makes you do is personally relate to some of the historical events in a time frame, if not with glimpses, maybe hunches, dreams, intuition, and imagination, something that may happen to you and makes you feel compelled to try to do something about it and to avoid danger, and sometimes take a passage around it that may be safer or even warn someone else. So what you can learn from these challenge of choices that may be intuitive that people are faced with through life, as in Doorways with Time, could be surprising and sometimes shocking, but at least it causes us to stop and think a little more about glimpses of the future that we may have ourselves from time to time.
If you could go back into time, Cheryl, where would you go?
Oh my goodness, what a question.
I know. I know where I'd go.
Where would you go?
I would want to witness Jesus.
Oh, how fabulous.
The entire episode, from what he did to the crucifixion, I would want to just be there. How about you?
Yes, and rising from the dead. Oh, man. Yes, I don't think you could top that. I really don't.
You'd want to go back to time where I almost made you an offer to work in Detroit.
That's right. Now, that's been 2 or 3 years ago. That was when I was in Kansas City. And that was an interesting time. A lot of things have changed since then.
How many years ago was that?
You know, I'm very, very, very fuzzy at math.
I bet you are. Well, it was a long time ago. We're going to come back and take phone calls with Cheryl, conversations with Cheryl next.